Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Susan Maraney. She's the executive director of the Gray Panthers, which is an organization that encompasses much more than senior politics. But she has a background of about 20 years in progressive politics. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Susan, tell us a little bit about Maggie Kuhn and the origin of the Gray Panthers.
Sure. Maggie Kuhn worked for the Presbyterian Church back in the 70s, and she was forced to retire at age 65. And felt that that was incredibly unfair. She felt like her life was just starting and that she had so much more to offer. And so she got together with a few other women that were in the same situation and started the Gray Panthers. They soon became intergenerational because they were working against the war in Vietnam. So in as much as we were started by Maggie, who was a senior, who was focused on retirement and anti-aging issues, she very quickly moved the organization movement at that time into intergenerational issues of peace and justice.
Was there ever any formal connection between the Gray Panthers and the Black Panthers?
There was a connection. I mean, at the time, Maggie had gone to some great, Black Panther meetings, and we both really kind of had the same mission. It wasn't a formal connection, but there was a connection there.
Now, there have been a number of senior politics kind of organizations around over the years, and the AARP, of course, is this enormous gorilla on the block. So what is the niche? I talked recently with Ed Coyle from the Alliance for Retired Americans, which is the AFL's senior organization. And what is your niche? And I know that you don't think it's just a senior niche. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, our mission is to work for social and economic justice and peace for all people. And, we're an intergenerational movement that works to create a humane society that puts the needs of people over profits. And so we're not ageist in that we don't only work with seniors. We believe that issues that are important to seniors are also issues that are important to children and vice versa, and that the generations have so much more to learn from each other, and that when you start, saying, well, this is a senior issue, or this is a children's issue, or this is a middle class issue, somebody's always a winner and somebody's always a loser, and we just don't stand for that. We believe that everybody should win, and that, for example, Social Security is not just a senior issue. It's an issue for everyone in America.
So
that's more our niche, is that we're intergenerational.
Well, that's an obvious important political point about intergenerational solidarity, but it seems like you might need to do a little bit of rebranding. As long as you're called Gray Panthers, it's going to be a bit of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a discussion every year. I mean, the gray in our name does signify that, yet we are also very much known for being the Gray Panthers, so we don't change it. So when we have an opportunity like we do today, we like to get the message out that we are not just about seniors, but we believe that seniors have much to contribute in every discussion on every issue. And back when Maggie was forced to retire, that wasn't necessarily true. Retirement meant, golfing and shuffleboard and kind of just getting together with people of your own age only. And it's changed a little bit since then, but there's some great senior power, but we want to make sure that it doesn't go back the other way, and that seniors aren't really just regulated to being by themselves and with each other.
I think I first paid dues to the Gray Panthers back in when I was 30, about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that attracted me about the Gray Panthers back then was this critique of ageism. It seemed like it had taken the 60s civil rights and disability movement and feminist movement critique and model of consciousness raising about those kinds of oppressions and internalized assumptions and applied it to the aging plight.
Mm-hmm. True. Very, very true. Very, very true. I think, you know, we've had, in this country, we put people in nursing homes when they get older, and they're not only older, but they also have people with disabilities. So we, in essence, shut them away. And when people are getting older, it's when they have just so much more to contribute because of experience and knowledge.
Do you think there's a connection between somebody like Leon Kass, the president's bioethics czar, saying that we have an obligation to die at a certain point in our life, and that the attempt to live vigorous, healthy lives as long as possible is a bad thing, and those kinds of ageist assumptions that the Grey Panthers have been fighting?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, we stand for quality of life. And once again, you know, at age 65, Maggie felt like she was just starting and was pretty much felt like she was putting out to pasture. So, yeah, I mean, we truly, truly believe that people should be able to live their fullest lives in the highest quality possible.
So the connection then to medicine is obvious. One of the issues that I've also liked about the Grey Panthers is that it's long been an advocate of single payer, and the AARP has never fully embraced single payer. It's
right.
It's been defending Medicare in a kind of parochial and sectoral way.
Sure.
And the Alliance for Retired Americans, I think, is pro-single payer. But is that one of the strategies of the Grey Panthers to argue that, hey, look, Medicare is not just for seniors, it's for everybody? It could be for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, we've been advocates of single payer for years, and but we also are advocates for incremental change towards that. And, you know, the Medicare system prior to this recent passage of the Medicare Modernization Act, which was back in 2002, was a really good example of a national health care program that worked. I mean, Medicare is an incredibly popular program. It still is. And so and it's interesting because America's not quite ready for a national health care plan. I don't know that we're anywhere near that at this point. But the success and the popularity of Medicare leads us to believe that down the road, hopefully we'll see something similar to that. I mean, the fact that I think it's 48 million people are without health care and millions more don't have basic benefits. I mean, you start to read about what people are losing in that. I mean, we're talking about a huge loss of life. So we need to start looking at this creatively, and that is part of our platform. I mean, we're very, very strong on health care.
I'm speaking with Susan Maraney. She's the executive director of the Grey Panthers, a lobby for many different kinds of social justice issues. I'm Dr. Jay, and this is Change Surfer Radio. Now, let's talk a little bit about Social Security, the big issue on the table, which has brought great relief and joy to the hearts of many Democrats and progressives because of its apparent egg on the face of the president. But you caution that we should not be so quick to assume the demise of this alleged reform plan.
Yeah, I don't think this battle is over by any means. And I know, I mean, we've got networks that are actively working on this, and we are giving them those tools to do that. You know, America has always promised a decent standard of living to working people, and it feels like that's been shifting. And it's shifting with the new discussion on Social Security. It's certainly shifting with the president's 2005 budget and cuts, you know, proposed cuts to Medicaid, which looks like it may not happen, but proposed cuts to Medicaid and housing and transportation. I mean, just kind of those basic services, I think, that every society really kind of needs. And so we've been seeing a shift in this. There was a Social Security fight back in 1980. There have been Social Security fights ever since the program was enacted in 1935. But this is a very, very important issue to us.
So you don't think that this issue, from our previous discussions, I intuit that you don't think that this issue is principally about a sincere concern that there's going to be a problem financing this program in the future. You think it's more of a symbolic way to continue dismantling the social welfare state?
Well, yes, we do. I mean, the first issue is the system is not in crisis. It's just not in crisis. And I mean, even the Social Security trustees report says that it's not right now in crisis. You know, the Congressional Budget Office says it's really not in crisis at all. And so, you know, there seems, it's kind of like the war in Iraq. I mean, we were sold this lie that Saddam Hussein was an immediate threat to the United States. He was not an immediate threat, but we were told he had weapons of mass destruction, and we had to do this immediately because, you know, we were going to be attacked, and he was a part of Al-Qaeda. And it feels like we're going through the same thing, you know, that Social Security is now in this crisis, and that if we can convince everybody that there's a crisis, then we can dismantle this program as we have been trying to dismantle other, you know, social programs, Medicaid, Medicare, housing programs, et cetera. And once again, America has always promised a decent standard of living to working people, but it really feels like it's shifting.
One of the things that's horrified Republican pollsters around the country when they do focus groups around Social Security reform is that the most popular reform of Social Security in all of these groups, Republican lay people as well, is to lift the cap on taxable income, which is precisely the opposite direction of what the Republicans want to do.
Right. You know, I mean, we've proposed a couple of ideas. I mean, I think we do believe that the system will need some tweaking. I mean, we do believe that. I mean, but it is not in crisis, and it is not in crisis now. Is it time to start looking at changes? Sure. But does it need the change of privatization? No, absolutely not. I mean, there are some things we can do. We can start to lift the cap on taxable earnings. You know, we don't have to lift it all at once. We can do it, you know, incrementally. I mean, there are other things we can do. We can include, there are about 4 to 5 million people who are state and local government employees that are currently not in the system. We could bring them into the system. We could allow people to retire when they'd like to retire. I mean, we get calls here daily from people who, once again, feel like they're being forced to retire and are losing their jobs when they're getting older. That doesn't have to happen. There could actually be incentives for people to save money, and we don't have the detail of what those would be, but there could be incentives that would certainly do that. We shouldn't be phasing out an inheritance tax, which the president, of course, calls a death tax, but it's an inheritance tax, and we don't need to phase that out. We need to keep that in. So, you know, there are different things that we could be doing, you know, so that we have ample money in the system in the future.
Well, you just mentioned mandatory retirement ages. Is there a Great Panthers policy about mandatory retirement ages? Are you for lifting or eliminating mandatory retirement?
No, we don't. We believe that people should decide when they want to retire.
So how about...
We do not believe in a mandatory retirement age.
One of the issues we talked about before we got on air was the notion of the old age dependency ratio. And I think that personally, I'm much more of a demographic pessimist about some of these issues. And I just want to touch with you on that policy, because we're going from 5-to-1 worker to retired senior ratio, mm-hmm. to, in the United States, at least a 3-to-1. And in Europe, perhaps a 2-to-1 worker to retiree ratio. And it seems like that's going to require some pretty fundamental renegotiations of our social contract. And I'm just wondering, it seems like it would be a tremendous opportunity for the Grey Panthers' message of intergenerational solidarity and for universal provision, as long as we're prepared for that. But if we just say, hey, there's not going to be any problem, that seems to be burying our heads in the sand.
Right, I understand that. And once again, we believe that the system is going to need tweaking. I think we're assuming, first of all, that all the baby boomers are going to en masse retire. There are trends right now that suggest that even if the baby boomers want to retire, that they're not necessarily going to be able to retire, and that's an intergenerational issue. The inheritance, the great wealth that many baby boomers are expected to receive may not in fact happen because of longevity in life, and their parents needing to spend that down on nursing home and long-term care. And then the baby boomers, of course, are sandwiched in between that because they've got their own long-term care needs to think about. You know, I've looked into long-term care. I can't afford it. You know, its insurance is over $1,000 a month. And so we're talking about two generations of Americans that are going to be living longer than normal. But, baby boomers aren't necessarily going to be retiring. And many baby boomers are talking about maybe retiring in what they're doing now, but then picking up another job. So I, you know, first of all, Social Security has always been in trouble. In 1970 or 1980, they were raising all these alarm bells that Social Security was in trouble. Well, it's not in trouble, and we've been hearing this ever since the program was implemented. So part of me is skeptical, of course, and the numbers obviously bear that out. But I also think that we're looking into a future that we don't necessarily see, and I think, you know, some of the proposed changes that I've mentioned, and I think some of the creativity of the American people can be put into finding longer-term solutions that don't have to dismantle a system that is widely popular.
Let's talk a little bit about the other kind of progressive coalition that needs to be gathered around to pursue the kind of policies that the Gray Panthers wants to advocate. On the left, we talked for a long time about the Rainbow Coalition, the need to pull all these different constituencies around. And part of the critique of aging, the nature of aging in the United States, allows, I think, some of those connections about how three quarters of seniors are actually women, and how increasing numbers of seniors of color are going to have disproportionate amount of poverty if we implement these changes. Can you touch on some of that for us?
Sure, and I'd be happy to, because I think what you and I have talked about thus far is the part of Social Security that is really the kind of retirement program. But Social Security is bigger than that. I mean, it provides disability benefits to people who are disabled before they reach retirement age. And that includes people of all ages. And it also includes spousal benefits. So 97% of Americans' children are benefiting under the Social Security program or are part of that Social Security program. So it's not just a senior retirement issue. It's a program that was really designed as a social program. Once again, that America has a responsibility to each other, or Americans have a responsibility to each other. And so I think it's really important that when we look at future fixes for the program, that all generations are part of that discussion. I've read the numbers on, you know, what age ranges and what, you know, who thinks that we ought to privatize the system and who doesn't. And it's current retirees that say we shouldn't privatize the system. And people say, well, that's because they're in it for their own benefit. But when you really talk to them, they wouldn't even be affected by the changes. They're talking about their children and their grandchildren. When you talk to younger folks, college-age folks, there seems to be a higher number that believes that we should privatize the system because, you know what, it's going to be gone anyway. Well, it doesn't have to be gone anyway. And I think, you know, if in fact we can put our heads together, all of us put our heads together, we can figure it out. I mean, we're financing a war in Iraq for billions and billions and billions of dollars, and Americans say that's okay. So when Americans want to come together and say, you know what, this is worth fighting for, whether the Gray Panthers agree with that or not, but, you know, if this is worth fighting for, we will fight to do that. The same can happen with social programs.
I know that the Gray Panthers has shrunk a little bit from the peak of its membership in about 20 years ago. And that's along with a lot of other progressive organizations, the organizations that I also belong to. What is the current nature of Gray Panther activism? If one were to join a chapter, where are the chapters? How can one connect with the activism that you're doing?
Sure. I think, we were, Maggie Kuhn was an incredibly charismatic founder and leader and brought, oh gosh, just thousands of people with her. And we experienced after her death, of course, some kind of a void like many, many organizations would. It's interesting. In the past few years, we've been gaining some strength as in members and as in interest in reviving some networks and gaining some networks. So the Medicare Modernization Act in November of 2002 gave us a huge lift. I mean, people were very, very upset about that and started to see, you know, with this Bush administration, the dismantling of social programs. And so there's actually been a renewed interest in our work. You can, if you are interested in joining us, call me at 1-800-280-5362, extension 28. Our website is www.graypanthers.org. And I'd be happy to talk with you. You know, our networks are really, they're all over the country, but we've got some real significant presence in some areas and we don't have presence in another. So, for example, we've got multiple networks in California who are just doing lots and lots of work around the Social Security issue and other issues. We've got an active network in, we've got a couple active networks in Florida. We've got a couple active networks in Michigan. We've got, I mean, they're just kind of in pockets all over. We've got a network in Rhode Island, a network in Wisconsin, one in Minnesota. I mean, I'm not going to give you all the states, but if folks are interested in becoming an activist or want to join the organization, they should call that 800 number.
Susan, I really want to thank you for joining me today. I've been speaking with Susan Maraney. She's the executive director of the Gray Panthers, an organization fighting for many good progressive causes, and some of which will have a positive impact on seniors. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having us.
Now I'd like to read a brief passage from my friend Ramez Nam's book, More Than Human, The Promise of Biological Enhancement, which recently went on sale. This passage is about overpopulation and its relationship to life extension. How will longer lives affect world population? Certainly anything that keeps people alive longer will increase the number alive at any given point. However, the details of population growth can be rather counterintuitive. Consider that today the countries with the longest life expectancies at birth have populations that are remaining steady or even shrinking. For example, the UN Population Division expects the populations of Japan, Italy, Germany, and Spain to all decrease over the next 50 years, despite the fact that Japan has the highest life expectancy of any large country, and the Western European nations are not far behind. At the other extreme, the countries with the fastest growing populations are those with relatively low life expectancies, countries like India, China, Pakistan, and Nigeria. Because the birth rate is double the death rate, phenomena that affect fertility can have a far larger impact than similar size effects on the death rate. For example, between 2000 and 2050, the UN expects around 3.7 billion people on Earth to die, while another 6.6 billion are born. Cutting the death rate in half would increase population by around 1.9 billion people. Doubling the birth rate would increase population by a further 6.6 billion people. Thus, the birth rate is a far more significant lever on the size of population. Projecting population growth into the future is a tricky thing, however. It depends on just how quickly economic growth improves healthcare, sanitation, and nutrition. It also depends on how quickly those important birth rates come down. The UN Population Division produces high, medium, and low estimates for future population. Birth rates and death rates differ by just a few percent between the scenarios, but over decades it adds up. In 2000, world population stood at 6 billion people. Looking forward, the UN predicts that in 2050, world population will be somewhere between 6 billion and 11 billion people, with a medium prediction of 8.9 billion. 8.9 billion people is half again as many as are alive today, yet in real terms, it represents a growth rate about half as fast as the last 25 years. World population grew by 50% between 1975 and 2000. The next 50% increase is predicted to take until sometime after 2050, around twice as long. Ultimately, the UN's medium model projects world population hitting a plateau of 10 billion people in 2100. Of course, projections 100 years in the future are perilous. They rely on generally smooth progression of current trends. They don't take into account the possibility of global plagues, world wars, or technologies that radically alter mankind. Life extension is just one of those technologies, yet its impact on population is surprisingly small. Demographer Jay Olshansky, despite being a pessimist about the prospects for slowing human aging, has shown that extending human life would have an incremental rather than exponential effect on population. The bottom line is that if we achieved immortality today, the growth rate of the population would be less than what we observed during the post-World War II baby boom, he says. If everyone were made completely immortal today, he calculates, and taking into account declining birth rates, global population would hit about 13 billion in 2100 rather than the 10 billion currently projected. The immortality Olshansky is talking about isn't achievable. If we halted all aging accidents, homicide, suicide, and infectious diseases would still kill people, nor is complete halting of the aging process in our sights today. More likely, we'll achieve the technology to slow but not halt the rate of aging in the next 10 to 20 years. Then it will take additional years for people around the world to gain access to the technology. Even then, the impact on population won't be instant. Those who are already old won't benefit much from techniques that slow their aging rate. Instead, it will be the middle-aged and young who reap most of the benefits. The combination of those factors suggests a gradual impact on worldwide population. Here's a simple mathematical way to look at this. We can't predict exactly when life extension techniques will first be available or how quickly they'll spread, so we'll need to make some guesses. Imagine that life extension techniques first appear on the market in 2015. In the year after that, 2016, let's say the overall death rate around the world drops by 1% as a result. And let's say that it decreases by another 1% each year thereafter, so that in 2017, age-slowing techniques have reduced the world global death rate by 3%, and that by 2050, they've reduced it by 35%. That's quite an optimistic scenario. It implies that by 2050, we've managed to increase life expectancy in the developed world to around 120, and in the developing world to around 113, an unprecedented rise in life expectancy even compared to what's happened in the last two centuries. If this extremely optimistic rise in life expectancy occurred, how large would the impact on global population be? If we simply reduce the number of deaths the UN forecasts each year by the percentages above, 1% in 2016 climbing up to 35% in 2050, we get a total population in 2050 of 9.4 billion people instead of the 8.9 billion the UN projects. 500 million additional people are nothing to sneeze at, but as a proportion of the projected world population for 2050, it's less than 6%. To put this in context, that's less than the percentage change in world population between 1970 and 1973. A noticeable change, to be sure, but not a catastrophic one. It's also worth noting that some demographers believe that birth rates in the developing world will drop faster than the UN's middle scenario. Just a 5% lower birth rate yields a scenario where the world population tops out at around 8 billion in 2050 and may come back down to below the year 2000 level of 6 billion in 2100. Achieving this is entirely plausible if the right resources are applied. A plateau and eventual reduction in global population depends on the spread of wealth, education, and freedom in the developing world. For example, the UN expects the population of Europe, not counting immigration, to shrink by about 0.4% per year between now and 2050. The overall population of the developed world, again not counting immigration, is expected to remain fairly constant. If the developing world can attain the present level of affluence of the developed world by 2050, we'll see overall world population level out and begin to drop. Again, that's a passage from my friend Ramez Nam's More Than Human, The Promise of Biological Enhancement, which went on sale just a couple weeks ago and has really been very well received. I highly recommend that you go out and pick it up. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.